You've been lied to, but you don't know how. You've searched. You've struggled. You've cried out. You want the truth, but where is it? You've wandered. You've fought. You've strived, and you have not been satisfied. What is truth? Where is truth? Who is truth? The kingdom of God. Mind control. The last days. Higher dimensions. Unity. The power of faith. Discovering the truth. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but through me. God has promised that He will hide us under His feathers, and under His wings we will trust. His truth shall be our shield and our buckler. Discovering the Truth with Dan DeVaughn is the premier program that is designed to center you on the kingdom of God, to equip you with faith in Jesus Christ, and to unveil the truth behind the lies. This program is designed to show you how to become more than you have ever imagined through the power of truth. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. And now, prepare for your host, Dan DeVaughn.
You're listening to Discovering the Truth with Dan DeVaughn. This show is designed to center you on the kingdom of God, to equip you with faith in Jesus Christ, and to unveil the truth behind the lies. This program is a production of Bride Ministries, and you can find us at www.bridemovement.com. In just a minute, we will be bringing up my guest for today's program. His name is Doug Woodward, and we are going to be discussing several things, including the upcoming conference and his latest book, Uncommon Sense. Speaking of conferences, this weekend, November 8th and 9th, I will be at the webinar, web-based, internet-based Quest for Truth conference called Decoding the End Times, and I will be presenting a talk called Kingdom and the End of the Age. Folks, this is exciting stuff. I will be talking about how we are engaged with heaven right now, how heaven is run as a government that is designed as a kingdom, how this revelation plays into how Christianity is intended to be lived out and experienced in the earth, and how territorial warfare is done through kingdom protocols. Folks, we're talking about a lot of stuff. If what I just said sounds like Japanese to you, then you need to hear this stuff even more. Look forward to that. Hopefully you've had an opportunity to sign up at www.theQ4T, that's Q, the number 4T, conference.com. Another conference the following weekend will be called A World Turned Upside Down. Now, this is being done by the Prophecy Forum, of which my guest today, Doug Woodward, is a director. We're going to be talking about that a bit more, but look forward to it. It's going to be in Dublin, Ohio, and I will be there in person. As I've said in the past two episodes since relaunch, I am starting up a discipleship group. First, I was saying I'm thinking, but with the amount of response I've gotten so far, I'm saying I'm going to do it. We're going to do a discipleship program. We're going to start a discipleship group. And the questions I'm asking now are, Lord, what is going to be the focus of the group? How long is it going to last? I'm thinking somewhere around 8 weeks or so. And the format is still in development. But if this sounds like something you are interested in, getting an opportunity to have dialogue with yours truly, get some discipleship, prayer time, time for dialogue with others around a common subject during this process, contact me at bridemovement@gmail.com. I'm going to be limiting the number of participants. It's not just going to be an open, free-for-all kind of thing. There's going to be a limit. There's going to be a cap. I haven't decided what the cap is yet. I will say, if you've already gotten in touch with me, you're in. If you are still interested in doing this, I'm not dropping the hammer yet and saying, well, we've reached maximum capacity. But I am going to keep it small enough that there is an opportunity for relationships to develop as a result of this thing. And it's cool. If you do this, you're going to be meeting people you do not know from different places in the world. It's really going to be a unique opportunity where people from all kinds of different backgrounds are going to come together with the goal of learning something and growing. And so I think it's actually going to be something that's really cool. Again, you can reach me through my website, bridemovement.com, or bridemovement@gmail.com. I'm excited to announce that Kingdom Government and the Promise of Sheep Nations is just about to be released, just a couple more days, folks. And this book, product of over 4 years, over 440 pages of material, is about to be released. If you want to understand where I'm really coming from as an individual, what I see on the horizon and how God has dealt with me, this is the book that you want to get. It reflects the growth and the developing understanding that I have obtained over the past 4 years since the release of my book, Noah's Ark and the End of Days, and not so publicized fact, I actually started writing Kingdom Government and the Promise of Sheep Nations before Noah's Ark and the End of Days even went into print. So we're going back that far. This book has been edited, revised, reorganized over and over and over again over the past 4 years. God's finally given me the go-ahead, said it's time, release it. And so here it is. I encourage you to grab that. It's available as an ebook, and that's all it's going to be available as initially. So if you're listening to this podcast, you'll be able to get it. Now, we're going to go to our guest in just a minute. I want to exhort you before we go there with a passage that I bring up to people from time to time because it just comes up in conversation. But this is a passage that is so, so overwhelmingly misunderstood or not understood at all. And I'm going to present it to you right now. In Ephesians chapter 3, Paul is talking about his call and what he was called to do. And in verse 8, he begins in the Amplified Bible. I like it because it really breaks it down. He says, "To me, though I am the very least of all the saints, this grace was granted and graciously entrusted." So he's talking about what his grace was to do, his assignment, and it was to proclaim to the Gentiles the unending, boundless, fathomless, incalculable, and exhaustless riches of Christ. Wealth which no human being could have searched out. Folks, first of all, you have to understand, the riches which are in Christ are boundless and fathomless. You see, Jesus has no shortage of supply. You think that Jesus is stingy because maybe in your experience, everything you've ever gotten or received in life, you've had to generate in your own power. What I want to say first is that God's not broke. God has no shortage of resources. Let me tell you, when you transition from toil to grace, and let me not preach this too hard before our guest gets on here, because we don't want to pull up the whole program on this point, but let me talk about this for a second here. See, God is rich, and he's not rich in just material things, because God's concerned with much more than material stuff, but he's not limited to non-material things. See, God can get you anything that you need for your calling, for your appointment. And when you move into grace, see, Paul's talking about the grace that he was given. You move into God's ability. You move into that place where you have synced with the purpose that God has for your life. You roll into God's ability. That transition places you in a position to actually receive and participate in the boundless riches of Christ, which is, guess what you receive as inheritance in salvation. See, this is a different kind of Christianity. It's when you are walking in lock and step with the resources of God. Let me tell you, kingdom living is living in lock and step with the resources of God. We're here to talk about the kingdom. Folks, I'm here to tell you, if you haven't been living in lock and step with the resources of God's kingdom, you need to roll into grace, which is God's ability, which is revealed when we are in assignment. We are living according to assignment, which is what Paul was doing. He was on assignment to preach to the Gentiles the riches of Christ. And you know what? Those riches of Christ, which he was preaching, he had grace to preach about it. But I'm telling you, these riches of Christ, which we inherit in salvation, allow us to move beyond toil and work and self-effort and into something called the rest of God. Now, he goes on, and man, I just want to get to verse 10. Okay, I'm going to skip verse 9 because verse 10 is really something special. It says, the purpose is. So in verse 9, he talks about the mystery of God, and then he says in verse 10, the purpose is that through the church, the complicated, many-sided wisdom of God in all its infinite variety and innumerable aspects might be made known to the angelic rulers and authorities, principalities and powers in the heavenly sphere. Can I tell you, the work which God accomplished in the church, in every individual, and then corporately the church, through salvation, by grace through faith in Jesus Christ, is for the intent that God can declare his wisdom to, guess what? Guys that live in the heavenly sphere. Higher dimensions. Other realms. These are where the principalities and powers, authorities, are existing. That's where they abide. The church has an assignment to reveal the wisdom of God in realms higher than the three-dimensional plane of earth. This is actually part of our ministry. Get your mind off of where your rent's going to come tomorrow, folks. There is something so spectacular about what God has accomplished and what he has assigned the church to do, the job that he has opened up in us. I mean, it is just incredible to think that, you know what? Yeah, we're here preaching the gospel to people, talking about what God did for us, giving our testimony. But God is revealing in heavenly places, right? And this is spiritual function. His wisdom to principalities, literally fallen angels are looking at the spectacle of the church. And you know what? God is displaying to them his wisdom in that place, in that realm, above the sphere of earth. Folks, this is exciting. This is incredible. You have no idea just how impactful the work of salvation is in your life and how you, in your life, in your conduct, what you do, touches not only the realm of earth but also realms above. It is incredible. But folks, enough on the kingdom. There'll be more later. We're going to go to break and come back with our guests. We're going to talk about so many things. I mean, we're going back to the founding fathers, masonry. We're going to get into Nazism and all this stuff. I mean, it's just crazy. That's why we're here, to discover the truth. Folks, don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Back on Discovering the Truth with Dan Duvall, sitting down with our guest, Douglas Woodward. Now, folks, let me remind you, Doug is with a group of people. They call themselves the Prophecy Forum. They're having a conference coming up. We're going to talk about it a little bit with him. He is the author of a number of books on the topics of Bible prophecy and American history. His most recent book is called Uncommon Sense. We're going to be talking about that today.
Now, he is a member of the board of directors of the Prophecy Forum, and he has extensive experience in the private sector and has also served in various leadership capacities in the church. Now, his personal website is www.faith-happens.com. His group, the Prophecy Forum, of which he is the president, is found at www.theprophecyforum.com. Now, Doug, I want to start off before we get into your book and just give you a few minutes. Now, last week I had on Doug Krieger and John Holler, two of your associates, and we talked about your upcoming conference, and I want to give you another chance to make a little pitch, talk about it a little bit, let people know what's coming up.
Yeah, well, thank you, Dan. It's great to be with you again. We've had the privilege to do a number of programs together.
Yes, we have.
Various formats and venues, and this is great to be with you again. Yeah, we have been planning this group. The Prophecy Forum was founded a couple years ago by Gonza Shimura, Doug Hamp, and it's gone through several sort of progressive stages. We kind of reconstituted it about 5 months ago with Gonz, with myself, John Haller, Douglas Krieger, and Gary Winkleman. So there's five of us now that serve as directors, and basically, you know, it's not like that we've got lots of other people. So yeah, we're directors, and we're also chief cooks and bottle washers and all that too. and so we have been working diligently though on constructing a vision for what we want to accomplish. There are a lot of conferences and prophecy conferences and things like that. We're trying to do something that certainly that's the core of what we're about, but it's not just that. We're trying to create, a kind of a community amongst those in the eschatology area that people, students that have, you know, interest in, Bible prophecy. There are so many. What we found, one of the needs we found is that there are so many that are interested in apocalyptic issues, Bible prophecy, sure. Some of it kind of into the conspiracy theory world and how all that kind of fits in. But most people that come to these kinds of conferences have really felt alienated from traditional churches. And so there's really a need for a community of sorts. And so we're hoping also to provide resources to individuals and groups that form house churches in their locales, in their regions, in their cities. And so we're hoping to do that as well. But we will focus on conferences three or four a year as the Lord leads. And this first one is in Columbus, Ohio, specifically Dublin, which is a very nice suburb of Columbus. November 14, 15, which as we record this, that's just about a week and a day away. Mm-hmm. And we expect to have over 400, probably between 420 and 450 people at the conference. And then we also will be live streaming. We have a few tickets left, not very many. So anyone that's hearing this, they better rush to, if they want to attend in person, they need to get to theprophecyforum.com. And purchase a ticket. If they can't make it, then it is going to be live streamed, and we have spent a lot of time and effort on that, so we expect to have a very high quality presentation available through those means as well. So some great speakers. I could just comment and kind of run through the list of who's going to speak. Besides the directors I've named, We also have featured speakers, Bill Salas, who is really considered one of the top prophecy scholars in our day, has written a number of books, Psalm 83, Israelistein, most recently The Prophecy of Elam, which is really about Iran and whether or not there is a coming nuclear showdown or showdown over nuclear weapons in Iran with Israel. Chris Putnam, who's written two or three kind of big bestsellers in this niche of eschatology, Exo Vaticana, Petros Romanos, most recently The Supernatural Worldview, and Chris will be speaking. Let's see, Hagman and Hagman, Joe and Doug Hagman, who have a very popular radio ministry and program. They will be there leading some panel discussions and actually broadcasting a live show next Friday night, the 14th of November. And so we're really pleased to have them with us. Russ Dizdar, who is a friend of yours and mine that we know from, the Chicago conference that we were all at about 18 months ago. Mm-hmm. And, Russ and I've been privileged to do a number of conferences with Russ. Russ is a real spiritual warrior, you might say. And, he has done a lot, written the book, The Black Awakening, is an area that you and I have studied quite a bit, which is the dissociative identity disorder, satanic ritual abuse, and so forth. And
that's
so,
right.
So Russ will be there. So I'm probably leaving some people out. Oh, Dave Dobenmeyer, who has Past the Salt Ministries in the Ohio area, and Dave will be speaking. And who else am I leaving? I'm probably leaving out, of course, Krieger, Woodward, Haller, Winkleman, Gons.
Well, it's it's quite a lineup, and I know almost everybody that's going to be at this conference, and I'm excited because I'm going to be there.
Yes.
And I'm going to be there in person. As a matter of fact, you guys have invited me to be a part of a couple of those panels.
Indeed.
Talking about some things, and so we're really excited about that. Folks, if you're listening, you can still get a ticket. They can go to theprophecyforum.com, right?
Right.
And that's where they can get those tickets and information and sign up for the live stream if they're not able to make it out in person.
Right. We have about 10% of our tickets left, about 40, 45 tickets out of the 420 or so that we're selling. And there's still a few tickets left. But I'm not sure, Dan, when this will be broadcast, but they are going fast. So if you're hearing this now and you're interested, you better get there.
that's awesome. Thank you for the heads up. And folks, with that said, we're going to transition now and get into Doug Woodward's book. Now, I've read a number of Doug Woodward's works up to this point, and I will say that he is an incredible researcher. I just don't know how you find the time to look up all of these different sources to write your books. I don't. I mean, you get so many. I spend a lot of time personally as an author. I spend a lot of time meditating on my own material and what I'm going to put together and so forth. But you really, get into as much of the other material that's put out there as possible. How do you do it?
Part of it is that I'm a lot older than you.
Oh, so okay. Don't say that too loud.
A lot of books. You know, I may sound young, but I'm actually about 30 some years older than you. So, and I don't have to get more specific than that, do I? I hope.
No.
So I've read a lot, and I continue to read quite a lot. I'm just insatiably curious about things, and so curiosity really drives my level of interest, and then the internet, man, if you can just think of the right way to phrase the question, you can go out and grab information in a hurry and do a lot of research quick, and so I think that's a factor as well. So it's a lot of reading, a lot of research, and I type really, really fast. So that that helps writing books too. So
yeah,
I'm really,
that's a good skill to have.
Yeah, it helps, no doubt.
Well, in this book you have now, Uncommon Sense, this is getting into a lot of information, and I'm going through it, and I'm saying, this is just really important stuff. History, how the spirituality of America has been systematically corrupted, not just recently, but over a long period of time. There's been an infiltration of various unbiblical and unchristian approaches to spirituality. And your book kind of chronicles that. And, you call it uncommon sense. You actually tie it to politics. And you're saying we're going to take a step forward. We're not going to leave it as a spiritual discussion or a history lesson. Now we're going to begin to make some conclusions on political views. How does that come together in this book?
Yeah, well, that was kind of what I noticed as I was writing, and I talk about that in the introduction. But, I I've always thought of myself as not particularly political. You know, I don't go to lots of campaign events and, you know, and get all excited about elections. And, you know, in fact, last night, the midterm election was last night. I just read about it this morning. You know, I was kind of like, I knew what was going to happen. I knew the Republicans were going to win the Senate. That was just obvious. And so, you know, so I pay attention to politics, but I'm not really, you know, just sort of eaten up with them the way some people are. Mm-hmm. Cause I really, at the end of the day, I believe that there's not as much influence as the public is led to believe over what happens in this country. You know, that's a discussion we can get into more as we go, but, I really believe that the issues that affect us are fought on a different plane. And, you know, to some extent, agreed, that it is a supernatural plane. It's the powers, the principalities. It's a biblical worldview that says that there are spiritual forces that are behind the scenes, and they are not entirely pulling the strings, because that makes it sound like that we don't have free will. And I think we do, but they are heavily influencing what happens. And then there's another layer of the very rich and the wealthy. In times past, it was primarily the kings and the priests. In our days, it's the corporations and the bankers. To some extent, it's still some of the kings. I still think that the monarchies of the world have an undue amount of influence, but today it's probably more bankers and big corporations that influence things. The world, essentially, if one understands the proper definition of fascism, mm-hmm, the world essentially is all a fascist state now. Governments and corporations cooperate to further the interest of the wealthiest amongst us. And so, you know, it's to some extent an illusion as to the kind of power that the people are supposed to have. And yes, there is more freedom in the United States. There's more freedom of speech. We're pleased about that. Then, you know, I watched a documentary last night on Putin and Putin's rise to power and kind of the way things are in Russia. Russia is rapidly moving backwards towards the kind of central control, and has already gotten there, really. State control, the FSB is really the new KGB, and it's as dominant as it once was in the Soviet Union, you know, 30 years ago. So anyway, so I'm aware of all these political realities, and I try to, in uncommon sense, what I'm trying to say to folks is that they need to be aware of the spiritual influences that have been ongoing in our country, and really since the inception. The country was founded by, on the one hand, the Puritans at Plymouth Rock, but it was also founded by the Freemasons at Jamestown. And you really had a utopian vision in Jamestown. You had a biblical vision in Plymouth, and the wheat and the tares have grown together for the, you know, 400 years in the United States. But it's become, in the last 150 years, as we really look at spiritualism and its growth in the 19th century, it's really been since that time that, and certainly in the 20th century, where a spiritualist, supernaturalist, occultic worldview has begun to gain the upper hand in America. And America today really has three worldviews: Christianity, Judeo-Christian views, which is relatively small compared to the other two. One of them is just naturalism, atheistic naturalism, secular humanism. And the third is really the occult. And the occult is, you know, comes in the form of the New Age movement and other forms of mysticism, esotericism, and so forth. But they're really those three worldviews. And the purely atheistic worldview is probably still number one, but the supernaturalist spiritualist is probably number two, because there's so many people that are influenced by Eastern mysticism, the New Age, and so forth. And the Judeo-Christian worldview is number three, and it's losing ground rapidly to the others. And so it influences everything: our politics, our society, our culture, and that's really a lot of what's behind writing the book Uncommon Sense.
You know, and it's saying a lot. And there's, just in what you just opened up with, so many directions I'd like to go. You know, I find it interesting. I like to call America a corporatocracy.
Mm-hmm. That's a good word.
It's where the corporations basically make the rules. And what we do as the common people is we pay the corporations to go down to Washington and lobby our senators to tell us what we want.
You got it.
And so who's really making the rules? It feels exactly like you said, like that fascism thing going mm-hmm. on, the corporations conglomerating with the power heads. And a lot of these power heads, as we both know, descend from bloodlines, which are traceable. And many of these bloodlines are heavily, heavily given over to certain spiritual approaches.
That's right.
And so, you know, I want to get into this more, because here's one thing I think a lot of people miss, Doug. When you talk about something like the separation of church and state, first of all, it's not in the Constitution. That whole concept it came later, and it came not as law, but as more like policy, as some lawyers have explained it to me. And this is the truth, though. People say, well, you have to leave church at home if you're going to get into politics. Well, hold on. Occultists don't leave occultism at home when they get into politics, necessarily. You can't leave your belief system at home. Your belief system is going to determine your morals, which is going to determine your approach to how you're going to respond when a piece of legislation is put in front of you. And it's going to color your view on whether or not abortion is right, or, you know, the capital punishment is permissible, or, you know, anything that deals with the question of, is this moral or is this not? Transhumanism, what's permissible and what's not? How do we classify what humanity is and what is not? You can't leave your spirituality at home and get into quote-unquote politics and pretend like they're two totally separate things, because spirituality determines worldview, determines morals, and these things are inextricably connected. So let's get into some of the conflict that came into this country in its founding. You mentioned you had the Puritans, you had the Freemasons, they've grown together. Why don't we start off by exploring that a little bit?
Sure. Sure. Well, the concept of the fate of America, where, you know, what was the plan for America? There are a number of occultists that I have read. Some people, you know, I think I've gotten criticism lately because of the studies that I do. People are assuming, because I quote a Peter Lavenda or a Manly P. Hall, that I must be an occultist. Boy, I can guarantee that that's not true. Okay. I happen to believe in the blood of the Lamb and Jesus Christ as
Amen.
The only unique divine Son of God. And so, I teach these things and you know, evaluate these things, analyze them, and present what I think is the contrasting point of view. And so, just to clarify that, so as I quote a Manly P. Hall or whatever, don't think that means I agree with him. I totally disagree with him. But anyway, having said that as a preface, Manly P. Hall is probably the leading historian for Freemasonry. And Hall talks about in his books, The Secret Destiny of America, The Fate of America, that America had been planned for hundreds of years, probably came to a head with Francis Bacon, the society in England, the Royal Society, in which Christopher Wren, a number of other famous names living just before Sir Isaac Newton, who was kind of in the middle of and the end of the 17th century, so it was sort of 50 years before Newton. You had the Rosicrucians, and you had the sort of the advancement of the Rosicrucians and the merger or moving into a less occultic sort of incarnation in the Freemasons. And it was sort of in the 17-somethings that there was a merger of the various lodges and all that. But, you know, long story short, there is that the plan, as it's called, or the great work, was to create in the New World a government that was based on reason, not religion, that was based upon a republic, not a monarchy. And it was believed by the erudite, that these intellectuals, that that a new world meant a new opportunity to eradicate the old monarchy, the old priestly class of the Catholic Church, and to break humankind free from their hold. And so that was what the New World was to be about. And so Bacon wrote a book, kind of a play called The New Atlantis, and he envisioned that America would be the New Atlantis and it would be a country based upon these principles. And to a great extent, the founding fathers, as many have pointed out, were Freemasons. They were influenced by that. Some of them, they were also Christians, and they did not see necessarily see a conflict. David Barton, sort of Glenn Beck's favorite historian, talks about some of these things. And but it all begins with the Freemasons and their plan to create this kind of republic. And the Puritans and the Christians had a bit different idea. They saw in the New World kind of they were pretty much all millennialists. They believed, or postmillennialists maybe more, that the church in the New World would create the kingdom of God. And so their view was that we needed to be a Christian nation. We were a Christian nation, and that we would develop according to that scheme. And so you had, you know, two very different views of what should happen in America. And both have worked side by side. That's what I mean by the reference to Jesus as the wheat and the tares. And but it was really in the 19th century that there's a district, Mitch Horowitz has written a book called Occult America, talks about the burned out district in rural New York, which is sort of western and then upper state New York. And it was in these areas, they called it burned out because frequently you had evangelists traveling through and they were preaching hell, fire, damnation. And that fire would sort of, you know, that revival fire gave rise to the burning of those areas. And it was sort of in that 1810, 1820, 1830 time frame where you began to have spiritualism arise in America. And spiritualism originally was really kind of a nature religion, sort of wedded to Christianity. And this is out of that that Mormonism sprang, Joseph Smith, and all of that kind of American, you know, we talked a little bit between us about Andrew Jackson Davis, who was this medium that lived in the middle of the 19th century, and he kind of sprang out of some spiritual healing and ghost kinds of paranormal types of things that were happening out in New York. And so you could kind of go down, you know, a number of different threads, but that was really the genesis of spiritualism in the United States, was in New York, and it was in the early 19th century. And then it grew through Andrew Jackson Davis, and he was kind of the gateway to Henry Still Olcott and a woman that we know as HPV, Madame Helena Petrovna Blavatsky. And then with Blavatsky, she becomes the gateway really to the modern occultism and the impact of spiritualism upon the world ever since.
Yeah, she did a huge, she dealt the world a huge number. Okay, let's talk, because you're talking about this time frame, mid-1800s.
Right.
One of the points you brought up in your book that totally threw me for a loop was when you introduced a certain president by the name of Abraham Lincoln. Now, first of all, I have to say this. Doug, I don't want to hear anything bad about Abe Lincoln. There's so much bad to say about so many of our presidents if you really look into who they were and what they did. I mean, it just is depressing. And the more I learned, the sadder it gets. But I have always looked at Abraham Lincoln as this shining, like, example of, you know, a real man's man, somebody that stood up for what they believed in, had a moral foundation, and he's the one that ended slavery, for crying out loud.
Mm-hmm.
What a powerful testimony to say that's my deposit.
When it became expedient to do so.
But then you bring up in your book that he was tied into the whole spiritualism thing to an extent. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, it really was his wife, Mary Todd Lincoln, who was very, you know, intrigued by the occult. Abe, I think, was just humoring her. So there were seances at the White House. I mean, virtually every president, you know, has, since Abraham Lincoln, has had an occult advisor, astrologer, or whatever. Lincoln, as you read some of the dialogues in terms of some of the things that he said, you know, he had different mediums that would come and they would sort of go into their little trance and, you know, and give utterances from beyond. And it's almost as if Lincoln was just sort of, yeah. In fact, he said, yeah, I said, you know, it doesn't appear to me that the, you know, that the spirits have any better insight than my cabinet. What do you think? And he turned to one of the secretaries of the cabinet who was at the seance and he kind of went, well, I don't know. And, but anyway, Lincoln was, you know, he was a skeptic, I think. But he allowed Mary to pursue these things. I think it part of it was her story was the story of so many Americans, you know, during the course of the 19th century, infant mortality was extremely high. Virtually everyone in New York City had lost a child or knew someone that had lost a child recently. Then you had the Civil War that had, you know, hundreds of thousands of people that were killed. And so you had a clamoring all across the country to communicate with the dead. And Mary Todd, they had lost a child. They almost lost another. And they were just grief stricken. And so she was constantly wanting to communicate with the dead in the form of her family. And of course, after Lincoln was assassinated, she then started spending even more money, on, I think it was Richard Lincoln, Abe's and Mary's son that said, you know, she's just lost it. You know, she's basically out there spending money on these spiritualists. And he basically had her put into an asylum for a while because she was so captivated and so caught up and obsessed with all this. So I don't really criticize Abe for this. I think it was part of the culture of the time. And I think he was just humoring his wife and he was kind of putting up with it because she wanted to do it and he loved his wife dearly. And so I kind of think that's where Lincoln was, but I would say that some of Lincoln's shots across the bow were awfully funny.
You know, I was just reading your book and I'm like, seances in the White House, Abe Lincoln. Oh, come on. But, well, you know, when you put it like that, at least it still casts somewhat of, you know, he's not all gone.
No, Abraham Lincoln was a great man and he had great ideals. And I took the shot on him about the Emancipation Proclamation just because, you know, that wasn't, you know, the war against slavery, really, that's become a little bit of an American sort of rewriting of history. It, you know, there was obviously the abolitionist movement, but the abolitionist movement was not necessarily the primary issue. You know, Lincoln was trying to preserve the Union primarily to keep the Europeans out of North America because it was believed that a united America could resist Europe. But if America was divided into two, that the French and the English would carry their wars over into America. And so it was all about preserving the Union. And so it became expedient at some point to begin to promote the Emancipation Proclamation and to quote unquote free the slaves. And, but it was, you know, I think the main thing is that, yes, I think Lincoln wanted to do that all along, but I don't think that was his number one agenda item.
You know, and I read a book called 50 Years in the Church of Rome by a guy named Charles Chinnicky. I'm not sure if you're familiar.
No, I'm
but
not.
But he was a Catholic priest who then gave his life over to Jesus Christ and essentially became a Christian. And he was also an advisor to Abraham Lincoln. And right when he died, he released his book because it was a huge expose on a lot of things inside the Catholic Church, particularly that he identified as corrupt, and the whole war with the Jesuit agenda, which was heavily tied into the attempt to split the U.S. And it was Abraham Lincoln who was at war with the Jesuits over the the wholeness of the Union. And they so wanted a divided Union so that the wars could come here and it could stay divided because, you know, divide and conquer. And I was reading his book. I was like, man, this is just – this was my early days of conspiracy theory. And I said, wow. But no, what you're saying sounds right in line.
History. It's just good history. I mean, the reality is that – that you've had a war of the monarchists and the priests against the people, you know, ever since King Saul. I mean, you know, it goes all the way back. But the whole story of the American Revolution was really the Americans really wanting to stop the power and the control of the monarchy and the priestly caste, you might say. And unfortunately, it exchanged one form of elitism for another, because by about 1917, 1919, you had the creation of the Federal Reserve. And then you had bankers that all of a sudden became the primary dictators of power in America. And again, I don't think that's conspiracy theory. I think that's just that's maybe part of my uncommon sense. It's what few people know, but it's all public record if you're willing to go look at it.
That's true. Let's come back to Helena Blavatsky.
Yes.
All right. What was her role in the promotion of spiritualism in America?
Boy, it is far-reaching. Mm-hmm. We can even attribute the creation of science fiction to Madame Blavatsky, and I'll get to that in a moment. She was certainly the originator of the New Age movement. She did this in the form of theosophy. The story Mitch Horowitz talks about, which I cite in my book, it has to do with the fact that Henry Still Alcott, who had been in the War Department, he had a group of detectives that actually made the first arrests in pursuing John Wilkes Booth after the assassination of Lincoln. He was a forensic accountant. He caught a lot of fraud in the Union Army amongst contractors and so forth. He eventually went to New York. He became an attorney. Then he started writing for a newspaper, and he wasn't interested in law, and he wasn't interested in accounting. He became very interested in the occult. And he went out to Connecticut to a farm where there was a ghost show going on. And at this ghost show that he went out to write an article about, he bumped into this kind of bulky, heavy-set woman. And they started talking, and lo and behold, it was Madame Blavatsky. She was a Russian immigrant, and she claimed that she had been in the Himalayas and that she had been trained by the monks, the Buddhist monks in the Himalayas, that she had been in Egypt, that she had been a student of, the Egyptian Book of the Dead and all of these occultic sources from ancient civilizations. And he became fascinated with her, and so they sort of became buddy buddies. I don't know that there was any romantic thing going on there, but they became fast friends. And they moved to New York City. They had a location. They called it, the press called it, the Lamasery, like the llamas in Tibet. And they were together constantly, and they both channeled, and they both were instrumental in formulating the ideas of the Theosophical Society. And so it turns out that they ended up splitting up and going different directions. Alcott went on to Sri Lanka, or Ceylon as it used to be known, and became sort of the father of a rebirth of Buddhism, and created all kinds of schools in Ceylon. Blavatsky went back to England, then to India, and she wrote The Secret Doctrine, and she wrote what's the book on Isis? Isis Unveiled, I think it was. And but anyway, The Secret Doctrine became the sort of occult bestseller, written in the 1880s, and it was really the primary work, sort of the Bible of the occult, and it became influential in the Nazis, Heinrich Himmler and a number of those. But before I get ahead of that, the story there, Blavatsky talked a lot about Atlantis, about ancient races. She introduced the concept of anti-Semitism, basically, by talking about the seven root races, and that the Semites were an inferior one of the Aryan races. That's where the concept of the Aryan races really came from. So all of this occultic stuff from Hinduism, and Buddhism came together in Blavatsky. And it was the two of them together that really concocted an American version of the kind of the occult worldview, which included the paranormal, the miracles of the occult, sort of American individualism, the reliance upon the individual, the importance of the individual, and and striving for a scientific explanation for what was really going on. And you see that picked up in a number of the, like Camille Flammarion, Percival Lowell. This is where it kind of bridges into the whole story of Mars. And Blavatsky was very instrumental there. If we jump ahead and talk about science fiction, one of the more popular American science fiction writers is H.P. Lovecraft. And Lovecraft has written, you know, a number of books. He wrote really during the 1910s, 20s, early 30s, passed away before World War II. He was one of the main writers that gave birth to what's known as pulp fiction. Pulp fiction was primarily science fiction and detective stories. And H.P. Lovecraft became, you know, even after he passed away, became even more popular. Very obscure, very strange stories, The Cult of Cthulhu. He got most of these ideas from Blavatsky. And he did not believe in theosophy, but he found theosophy a great source of information around which he could create science fiction. And so the idea of ancient civilization, of ancient gods that once visited the earth. These are all notions that that Blavatsky, you know, talked about in The Secret Doctrine, and then kind of leaving that behind. And that really then is the bridge into kind of the worldview behind the Nazis and World War II, and that time in between World War I and World War II, where the occult, the Thule group, became a huge influence upon modern history. And so Blavatsky has a very key role to play in that as well. I'll take a breath.
Yeah, take a breath. Here's the thing that's so interesting. You know, here's Blavatsky getting started with her spiel and her books, Secret Doctrine and all that. Now, she's influencing two groups. I mean, more than that, but we have a huge group of people that are buying her stuff in America. And then we have a huge group of people that are buying her stuff. They end up calling themselves a bunch of Nazis.
Yes.
Now, you have both people pulling on the same source. Some of them are here. Some of them are there. But then, you know, you find this spirit of Nazism. And this is so fascinating to me. Here we have Nazism as the great enemy of the world in World War II. It collapses. And the death of Hitler is another conversation we're about to have. But ultimately, in response to the collapse of Nazism, what does the U.S. do but bring the spirit of Nazism right back into our country with Project Paperclip and other secret operations, including how they, you document this, ported Mengele in and out of the U.S. from his station in South America. What are you? Okay, so here we have a common source, a common thread here.
It's a tangled web, isn't it?
It's a tangled web, but it's like divide and then bring it all back and centralize it. They just came out with this movie, Captain America 2, Winter Soldier. In the movie, the whole theme of the movie is, guess what? All of the government officials are secretly Hydra. And Hydra is the counterpart in the comic for Nazis. And so it's like, oh yeah, all the government are now secretly Nazis. It's like, what are they trying to tell us here? Anyway, so we're going to come back around to that. When it comes to the Hitler thing, right? Hitler was this huge guy, very much into occultism. He did his own channeling. I mean, people, they have the stories and all that. Now, let's talk about Hitler for a minute. You branch off in your book and you give a whole section of the book to Hitler and to discussing why certain people believe he didn't really die. And I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about that and then tie it into the overall theme of your book and what you're communicating.
Right. There's it's probably in the last 5 years that there have been several authors that have taken up the subject of whether Hitler actually escaped to the Americas. I would say probably at the outset, whether he did or he didn't, it is, you know, Hitler's possibly coming to America is a symbol of the fact that thousands, if not tens of thousands, of Nazis, most of whom would have been war criminals, did come to the Americas, and they did, most of them came invited by either the Argentine government, the government Paraguay, the Brazilian government, and even the United States of America. And so Nazis were coming here in droves and droves for 5-6 years right after World War II. The authors that have really taken up this issue of Hitler and whether or not Hitler escaped to America, certainly Peter LaVenda talks about, you know, Hitler's escape in his book. Jerome Corsi talks about it in a book that he wrote, relatively short, but he brings up some new things that others had not brought up. The author's names escape me right now, but the book was called Grey Wolf, which was probably the most detailed discussion about how Hitler and Eva Braun and their dog Blondie came to Argentina via a U-boat, and it's a spectacular step-by-step story that you've got credible authors, I think, there. They were British journalists that investigated this. It's the kind of the backdrop to it is understanding that the biography that was really written about Hitler was written by, gosh, what's his name? All of a sudden I'm blanking on his name. But anyway, he was actually a member of MI6. In other words, there was some propaganda value in proposing that Hugh Trevor Roper, that's who wrote the book. He was MI6, and you know, it's very likely that the Allies wanted everyone to believe that they had gotten Hitler, kind of like Osama bin Laden, you know, the really evil guys. They, you know, they don't die, they just sort of disappear. And at least there's a lot of people that believe that, you know, the fact that we don't have a grave and he was buried at sea and all that. So, you know, Hitler was thought to have committed suicide in his bunker. But, you know, there's strong reasons to believe that the bunker had a back door. He escaped out through the subways and he actually got away. All these different accounts of the pilot that flew him from Berlin up to Norway, where he boarded, you know, on this other plane and flew to Spain. Then he got on a submarine and he went to Argentina. And I mean, it's elaborate, but it's believable. And there's so many accounts of individuals seeing him. And there's lots of memorandums written by people in the State Department and the military, you know, Department of the Army or whatever, where they were trying to track his whereabouts because they believed, as Stalin had always said, Hitler escaped. You guys are wrong. You know, the Russians later said they had a skull, as Jerome Corsi points out, the skull was skull of a woman and it wasn't a man. And
yeah,
it
was, that, you know, was so really interesting.
For years, supposedly, you know, that was the proof that we had Hitler. Well, you know, that was a hoax. And so, you know, you've got just all these accounts that these great researchers have done that have gone in and looked at all this data. And it really looks like it's very feasible that Hitler in fact did escape. I wouldn't swear on a stack of Bibles by any means, cause I'm not supposed to swear anyway. Mm-hmm. But do I find the evidence compelling? I find it disquieting, to be sure. It looks like it's very feasible that he did escape and that he lived out the remainder of his years until about 1962 when he passed away. And it looks like at a point there was a kind of a law of diminishing returns where the American government really did not want to continue to pursue it. And they just decided that as long as he keeps quiet, we're not going to go after him. So amazing.
There's so many unclosed coffins when it comes to the subject of World War II. The question of Hitler is one of them. The conversation about Mengele and what really happened with him is another one. The potential or possible Antarctic base that was established by the Nazis towards the end of the war is another question. People keep coming back and forth on this one.
Oh, yes.
was Admiral Byrd's account correct? Is it believable? Who knows? And I'm telling you, this is what I want to ask. When it comes to the Hitler thing, how does that change history? Okay, let's say he didn't die. And some of these accounts, they're right. Hitler survived to live on in South America for a while.
Mm-hmm.
What about history changes if we believe that?
Well, I think that that the biggest issue is not so much that Hitler may have survived. It's all of the information that all of us were taught in school about the outcome of World War II, who was behind it, who was paying for it, and what has happened since then. And, you know, in America, you really had a crisis that occurred in the 1950s where you had the Cold War going on. You had, you know, Alan Dulles. I think we may want to talk about him, but he was this.
Oh, yes.
The czar of the CIA, the former OSS, and which was the precursor to the CIA. And so you had the advent of the so-called military-industrial complex, and in effect the fascism that implied, that you had these large-scale military contractors that were influencing the government to go to war in order to continue to get large contracts to make airplanes and build, aircraft carriers and create new weapon systems and all that. And so that was what Eisenhower really was talking about, was, we must beware of the undue influence of the military-industrial complex, because it was very clear. He said that, just a couple of days before he left, and if he hadn't done such a nice job in World War II, he probably would have been assassinated before he had left office if he had started to spill the beans any sooner, because it really was at the base of what got Kennedy killed. Was the whole issue of the military-industrial complex. And, I don't know how many of the listeners have seen the movie JFK, Oliver Stone's story of Kennedy. Stone also has done like a 10-part series, the Inside Story of, or the Other Story of American History or something like that. Oliver Stone did for Showtime, I think it was, or HBO. But, there was a dramatic change in America. America all of a sudden went from a pretty true republic to a farce, in terms of how much influence Americans really had. I mean, Americans still do vote, and it still does make a difference, and elections do occur, but, it makes a big difference when the candidates have been pre-selected for you. And, that's a factor. And that's kind of the way the presidential races have been ever since. And, it's a big factor right now that doesn't matter that the Republicans took over the Senate, because essentially the Senate and the House are still immobilized for a variety of factors. But the Senate, you have to have a supermajority to overcome presidential vetoes and filibusters. And so the fact that the Republicans may hold 52 seats, it makes a few things easier, but not most. And so, the Congress is still very crippled. And so you have a president that rules through executive order. And that means, that for all intents and purposes, Obama is a Caesar. And he may appear to be a nice Caesar to some, but he's essentially a dictator ruling through executive order. And Congress has very little say in what happens. So,
what we've been watching him just pass executive order after executive order. And
right.
Every time my attention is brought to one of these new ones he's signed or whatever. And it's, where did you get the authority to do that? And it's like, oh, well, I gave it to myself.
Well, essentially it's true, because the Supreme Court won't stand against it, and the Congress won't stand against it. They could stand against it in the form of impeachment, claiming that by doing the things that he's doing, that he's breaking the laws of the Constitution. But most American politicians believe we live in a post-constitutional America, meaning that the Constitution is lip service, that it's not really what guides the laws of the United States. It's the new laws that the president, the Congress, and the Supreme Court, legislating from the bench, enforce upon the American public. No one is standing opposed to Obama, and for that matter, Bush. I mean, it's not like it's the Democrats are bad and Republicans are good. They're both influenced, you know, too much so by the corporation. And it's I'm not a communist. I work for great big corporations. But the point is that corporations know how to pull the strings of government to make the playing field uneven for competition, to create, in effect, monopolies and to enrich the rich.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. And then, of course, you add the fact that they're all in the same clubs. Same good old boys club, same country clubs. They go to the same retreats. Bohemian Grove, they go to the same, you know, some of them are invited to what's the name of it? I don't know. You got the Trilateral Commission, which everyone knows is populated by both Republicans and Democrats.
Council
on Foreign Relations, Republicans and Democrats. Like, well, whose side are you on? It's a lot of lip service to ideas that are propped up as big issues when really the really big issues seem to be agreed on. And it's what the corporations are in favor of and the power players are in favor of. So I just see this as clear as day. People that have listened to you, read your books, are going to be convinced of this without a question or, you know, follow this podcast very long. I want you to spend some time and I wasn't planning to have you talk about this, but since you brought it up. I really want to let you talk about it. The subject of the military-industrial complex. Now, this is a term that does get thrown around somewhat. But I think in the minds of a lot of people, there's not a firm understanding of what military-industrial complex really means and what it means for us right now in this country. So I want to turn it over to you and kind of let you give us your understanding of this subject.
Sure. Well, it was probably most pronounced and became – you know, really the impetus behind what happened in the 1960s, the Woodstock generation, all the protests. I watched the last couple of nights just to, you know, give your listeners, you know, sense of what I find entertaining. I listened to this long documentary on McNamara, who was the Secretary of Defense during the Vietnam years. Mm-hmm. And him, you know, more or less saying, well, it really wasn't me. It was President Johnson that wanted the war in Vietnam. And, you know, we rightly complain about 1,000 or so Americans that have been killed in Iraq, but it's hard for people to realize that 58,000 Americans were killed in Vietnam for a war that was based on ideology that was fundamentally not true. And, that ideology had to do with the concept that Vietnam was part of the Cold War and that we had to fight the Russians and the Red Chinese, as they were known at that time, through surrogates. And Vietnam was that surrogate. The reality is, as McNamara finally talked about in this documentary, was that the Vietnamese said, you guys don't study history. You know, we Vietnamese have been fighting the Chinese for 1,000 years. You know, we want our independence. This has nothing to do with communism. That's just the ideology of the day. Hmm. So, you know, there really was, as is often true, it's politics, you know, that influence thing. It's power. It's people trying to gain power. And the military industrial complex, you know, it's corporations that build aircraft, helicopters, they make machine guns, they build missiles. And they, you know, these weapons of war they create in order to sell them to governments around the world, and they do it to make a profit. Mm-hmm. And so the war machines of all of the nations are done primarily for profit motives. And it doesn't matter whether you're a capitalist or you're a communist. There are weapons manufacturers in all the nations, and they're all trying to make money, and the people at the top are trying to make the most money. And so it's it's all part of greed, and that's what drives that. The fact that people die, it's usually the people, it's the sons of the poor and the middle class that die. It's not necessarily the sons of the elite and the politicians.
So as an oversimplification, let's say Company A makes tanks. Company A is not taxpayer-funded. Company A is a for-profit corporation with stock. And as politician A, I have a private deal with company A, and I also have stock in company A. And I can make the call to go to war with country B so that now company A, which with which I am financially linked, will have a reason to make and sell lots of product.
That's right.
And when they sell lots of product, they're happy because they're making money, and I'm happy because I'm making money, and we're all happy. War is very profitable. Is this kind of an oversimplification of this kind of issue?
From the corporation's perspective, it's pretty basically true. You know, that I make, you know, I manufacture tanks and airplanes and helicopters, and I sell them to the government. And there are certainly bidding systems within the Pentagon, and those bidding systems allow for some competition. But when it comes to certain manufacturers, I did quite a bit of work in former times with the different corporations I worked with and partnerships. Mm-hmm. And there are ways to grease the skids, to, you know, to wire contracts so that so-and-so gets the contract as opposed to somebody else. And sometimes it's fair bidding. Not all the time is it fair bidding. But regardless, at the end of the day, what happens is that the government, the military specifically, gets equipment in order to fight wars. And what is worse is not just the corporations, it's really the bankers. And this certainly, we see this going all the way back to World War I, the Treaty of Versailles after World War I, especially in World War II, with the Union Bank Corp and a number of the other corporations that are banking companies that were supplying funding to the Nazis in order to facilitate the Nazi war machine, you know, growing to the point where it could engage and protect Europe from the communists and from the Soviets that the capitalists had also financed. Mm-hmm. And Hitler became too powerful. And so then the financiers financed the British and the Americans and their war efforts. And at the end of the day, the people that make the most money are the bankers. And what people don't realize is that the reason the bankers can make so much money and the reason why they don't cry when certain countries default on their loans mm-hmm. is that the banks invented the money to begin with. Mm. You know, if you and I have a loan and you failed, if I loan you $1,000 and you pay me back, you know, $200, I'm out of pocket $800. I've lost $800. But if a bank loans you $1,000, the bank invented that $1,000. It invented that $1,000 because it has a charter to be a bank. And so if you fail to pay that bank $1,000, it may say, well, you've paid me $300 in interest so far. You know, I'll just forgive that principal. I'll loan you another $1,000 and now start paying me more interest again. And on a big scale, that's what happens with nation states. Nation states pay interest. And if their principal eventually is not paid back, it's not that big of a deal because the banks invented the money to begin with. So it's not like the banks are actually out of money. All that they're hurt by is the fact that there are laws that prohibit them from loaning out more than, let's say, 30 times their capital. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm a financial guy, so I kind of understand some of this stuff, and it gets kind of heavy. But the main thing to realize is that, you know, how banks do loans is nothing like how we do loans.
It's,
you know,
it's not.
Yeah.
It's the not, more I've looked into the
money, you know, it's called the fractional banking system.
That's right. And I encourage everybody that's listening to this, if you have not researched the fractional banking system, do that. Do it, because it will revolutionize your way of thinking. You can't understand the way this country works if you can't understand fractional reserve banking. Now, I want to come back. So we're talking about the military-industrial complex, and you know, you've really done a great job with that subject. And the Pentagon, they do bidding for some of these contracts and allow for that.
Right.
I want to come back to Alan Dulles. Now, Alan Dulles was part of the whole beginnings of CIA and all that. And he's also tied in with the agenda to, I guess, invade America with Nazism. And I want to let you talk about Dulles, because I want people to kind of understand what's going on here.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's so much information. Dulles was an attorney, and he was an attorney for a number of the banks. He ended up becoming, during World War II, he was stationed in Switzerland, and there's this thing called the Bank of International for International Settlements. Mm-hmm. And the Bank for International Settlements was the means by which, you know, banks exchange, they'd have transactions, they'd exchange, they'd even up things. They basically, you know, settle accounts in Switzerland, the Bank of International Settlements. And it was the, it was really the banking facility that enabled the Nazis to transfer their monies out of Germany, into Switzerland before the war ended. Such that when they relocated to the Americas, those Swiss bank accounts would be protected. You know, we always hear about Swiss bank bank accounts and how they're protected and so forth and so on. Well, that's exactly right. They were set up, primarily to facilitate monies flowing to and from, Nazi Germany, during and after World War II. And, they still exist. It still is a principle. You know, influence in the world today.
Hmm.
We hear about the International Monetary Fund. We hear about the World Bank. You know, all these facilities were really created by these international bankers. And I sound like a great conspiracy theorist when I start talking about this stuff. Hmm. But you can look it up in Wikipedia. It's all, you know, laid out there. It's what really happens. You know, it's just the way things are. And, so Dulles was a key player in all this. And, Dulles was instrumental at the end of World War II in identifying German scientists that he wanted brought into America to enable the United States to better compete against the Soviets. And so there was a race in the last few weeks of World War II to get to certain places to grab certain Nazi scientists, so that we would get a better cadre of Nazi scientists than the Soviets would get. And England, by the way, was competing for scientists as well. And so it was the German scientists were really this great prize of World War II, and they went to these different countries. And then some, of course, as it's alleged, stayed independent by escaping via U-boats to northern Canada or to Antarctica, New Svebenland. And so you've got, you know, when the shink, what was the biblical expression about the rod is, you know, the sheep's rod comes down and the sheep are scattered or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And all these, you know, these Nazi scientists going all these different directions. And Dulles was instrumental in creating Project Paperclip and bringing, Wernher von Braun and his whole cadre of about 100 Nazi rocket scientists into the United States, and they were out at Fort Bliss in El Paso. They were in New Mexico. They later were at, I think it's called Red Rock in Alabama. I'm not sure. I may have that wrong. But it's different locations where these scientists worked, and it's really how NASA was built, was on the backs of these German scientists. Not that Jack Parsons in Pasadena and Robert Goddard and others didn't have a part to play. They did, but Wernher von Braun was the key figure, and a series of other German scientists. Not just rocket scientists, but social scientists as well. We talk about Mengele, Joseph Mengele, and the research he did with twins in Auschwitz. Just horrific stuff. He was also influential and was brought across eventually into the Americas. And that's another story unto itself, which we may have talked about before. But anyway, Dulles went ahead to pull together all of the different intelligence services of the United States. And eventually the, I guess it was called the National Security Act of 1947 was passed, formalizing the creation of the CIA, and something like 26 different intelligence services were brought together under the umbrella of the Central Intelligence Agency. And Dulles was the head of the CIA until about 1961. And it was under Dulles that the fairly infamous project MKUltra was also created under his with his desire and funding. And but it was during that time that the military-industrial complex, all of this incredible testing for the Manchurian candidate, which I've also talked about in my books. I don't talk about that in Uncommon Sense, but I do talk about it in Power Quest.
Mm-hmm.
But Dulles was instrumental in that. Dulles was key right up until the Kennedy, when Kennedy fired him as a result of him going behind Kennedy's back in the invasion of Cuba, the so-called Bay of Pigs invasion, in which Kennedy was more or less set up. It was a project that had been set up under Eisenhower, but it didn't go until after Kennedy had been was in office. And Dulles and some of his comrades and the CIA attempted this ill-fated invasion of Cuba by Cubans, and they wanted U.S. air support, and Kennedy refused to give it. And so it created this rift between Dulles and Kennedy. Kennedy fired Dulles and threatened to break the CIA into 1,000 pieces. Well, 2 years later, Kennedy was assassinated, and almost all of the conspiracy theorists place the onus for the death of Kennedy on the doorstep of Alan Dulles. And Dulles seems to have been a really key player, along with many other players that are of note, such as George H.W. Bush and others that were implicated in a lot of the research that's been done by so many different individuals. But Dulles plays this very pivotal role in the sort of the gateway between the old America and the new America, and is probably one of the, you know, darkest figures in American history that most people are barely familiar with him because of Dulles International Airport outside of Washington, D.C. That was Alan Dulles. He had a brother, John Foster Dulles, who was Eisenhower's Secretary of State, but he was not that key. Alan Dulles was the key guy.
Now, I also found it interesting, Prescott Bush, George Bush Sr.'s dad, wasn't he one of the financiers of Nazi Germany?
Yeah, that Senator Prescott Bush, I need to go back and look at some of the specific names of the different banks. But yes, Bush was, along with Dulles, Averell Harriman, a number of very pivotal American names, were involved in Union Bank Corp and different American corporations, which I do go into and talk about in the book, that were involved in the funding of various, the IBM companies, it's called, Ford Motor Company, GM. GM created synthetic fuel for the Nazis. The Ford trucks really facilitated the Blitzkrieg into Poland. You look at the American corporations that were providing, they provided the means for the Nazis to do what the Nazis did, and to, you know, create a, in really a relatively short period, about 6 year period, that the Nazi war machine was built up to where it became this enormous threat and a very real threat to all of the Western world.
And it's so interesting, because here you have, you know, Prescott Bush, and then his son, George Bush Sr., was also head of the CIA for some time.
Yep.
Then he graduated to president, and lo and behold, his cohort Dick Cheney was also in CIA and becomes vice president during his son's reign as president, also during the time where we're back at war in Iraq over, I think, one of the main things was oil. But, you know, here we are talking about spiritualism and its connection to politics.
Exactly. That is the kind of central thread behind the book Uncommon Sense, is talking about these things, because these individuals, it's not like they are naturalist atheists. Some of them might be, but many of them are not. They are heavily influenced by these spiritual ideas. You know, George H.W. Bush, George Bush 41 versus George W. Bush 43. H.W. Bush was the primary promoter of the New World Order. He talked about it in his speeches quite a bit. He gave $1 million to the creation of the Masonic, giant Masonic temple in Washington, D.C., not far from the White House. Mm-hmm. Very, very pivotal figure in the concept of the Freemasons and its influence in America. And, you know, as he always said, you know, the New World Order, it's all, you know, we have an opportunity for the New World Order. And, he is a very key guy in this. And yes, he was in the CIA. And as many have written about and talked about, he was very potentially the project manager. And everybody take a deep breath. He was probably one of the project managers for the Kennedy assassination. We don't have time to talk about that. I'd have to brush up on some of the data, but there's a lot there to say that's exactly what happened.
Well, I mean, do we have time?
You'd like that, wouldn't you?
I would like that. I'm sitting here. I'm like, oh, I mean, if you want to walk us down that plank, I will let you. Well, if you want me to take it another direction for now, I can.
Well, there's a particular movie. What I need to do is I need to look it up for you. I'll send you a note, and you can post it on your website or something that goes into this in great detail.
Okay.
Charts, shows all the connections of all the families and the connections of Bush to all these different individuals. The circumstantial evidence is overwhelming.
Hmm.
I talk a bit about this in Power Quest. I actually talk about it quite a bit in Power Quest Book 2.
Okay.
And the relationship of Bush and NASA to the Nazis, and how involved von Braun and some of the other Nazis may have been in the Kennedy assassination. Certainly Joseph P. Farrell talks about this in some of his books. But there is a lot of evidence that suggests that this is so. And you know, whether it is or it isn't, the main point is that there are very powerful people in this country. Some of them we know about, some of them we don't. They are very influential in what happens in politics. They are far more influential than the people, and that is the issue. It's unfortunately, you know, Abraham Lincoln's line, a government of the people, by the people, for the people, you know, shall not perish from the earth. Well, it did perish from the earth. It perished sometime in the 1950s, certainly into the 1960s, and it's not been the same government ever since. Yes, I'm glad I live in America, and it's still, compared to many nations, it's the freest nation for many things, that we can have this conversation and not face being thrown in jail for having this conversation is a testimony to the fact that we still have more freedom here than you would if you were having this conversation in Russia or some other locations. But that may change, and it may change very soon, because the government is not necessarily going to allow the freedom of religion to be maintained, because they're already cramping many people's style by the rules they're making about abortion, same-sex marriage, and a number of these other social issues, that the government is taking positions that are very much in conflict with what Christians have traditionally taught, believed, and how they've conducted themselves.
Mm. Let me ask you about Reinhard Gehlen. I don't want to end this program without letting you spend some time talking about this guy.
Well, Gehlen was he was the head of what's known as the Soviet desk during World War II. Worked for Hitler. He was the head of German intelligence. They did all the spying on the Soviet Union. And Gehlen was specifically the person that Alan Dulles made a deal with. Gehlen brought his whole crew of Nazi spies across to work on behalf of the U.S. government. He was, in effect, also the spy. It was the spy network for West Germany, and it was reinstated as the German CIA, in effect, once the East and West Germany were distinguished and there was a West Germany. So Gehlen's organization fed information to the U.S. government, which likely was false information in many cases, overstating the threat of the Soviet Union, such that Gehlen's organization could be given more funding. And it worked well in terms of supporting the military-industrial complex, because the Soviet threat was made bigger and bigger and bigger, such that more and more and more money – was devoted to the Cold War, to Vietnam. It created hysteria, more or less, in the United States. Not that there wasn't a threat, but it was somewhat of a self-perpetuating kind of situation. So, yeah, there really were missiles. I think the McNamara said in his documentary I watched last night, there was something like over 600 nuclear warheads there actually were in Cuba, and the United States government had no idea. They were still operating under the assumption that the warheads weren't even in Cuba yet. They already were there. And this is a conversation that McNamara had with Castro not that many years ago, talking about that, and that Castro would have recommended to Khrushchev that they should have used them against America, even though it meant the obliteration of Cuba because the United States would have retaliated. So anyway, so Richard Galen was instrumental in the buildup of the Cold War, and his spy network was really at the center of this.
And was he also a spiritualist or
following? That I don't know. That I don't know if he was. Uh-huh. Almost anyone in the SS, and I don't recall whether Galen was SS or not. He might have been. Von Braun was SS, but almost anyone in the SS were believers in the old kind of German religion, pagan religions, the Thule, the Thule, mm-hmm. Thule Society. They believed in the gods of like Thor and Valhalla and all of those kinds of pagan gods that that now we do movies about them, Thor and Winter Soldier and Captain America, and all that stuff, all of this sort of spiritual, fantasy. But the reason that it's become so popular is because there's so many people that are influenced by it that many of these people sort of partially believe it might be true. And so it tends to become a big part of our culture now.
With so many people, I guess, in power, taking the side of the frame of mind that the Constitution is not something to be upheld as much as it is a document to be given lip service. And
in many respects,
and given your view that America is Babylon.
Yes, we haven't talked about that, but yes, I believe it's Mystery Babylon.
You do.
Final Babylon of the Bible. Yeah. I do think that there's still elements of the Catholic Church and so forth. It's not like it's the only aspect of Babylon, but I think it's the primary aspect incarnation of Babylon in our day.
When it comes to the question of forecasting, and of course, understand when I ask you about forecasting, I'm not saying, Doug, prophesy to my audience and tell them what's going to happen in 10 years. All I'm saying is we're looking at trends. We're looking at, your opinion based on your research, the trends you've been following of the growing spiritualism, occultism in America. I mean, where does this ideology take us 5-10 years down the road?
Well, I am an apocalypticist. So I do believe that the apocalypse is imminent. Mm-hmm. I also believe that it's a fundamental part of the Christian gospel. The book I wrote before this book called Blood Moon, Biblical Signs of the Coming Apocalypse, really talks about the essential aspect of the kingdom of God, and that the teaching of Jesus was that the kingdom of God is at hand. And of course he taught almost 2,000 years ago, and no, the kingdom of God has not come upon the earth, and no, the apocalypse hasn't happened. However, the apocalypse, Jesus placing the apocalypse at the center of the message, it was not an accident. It was not a mistake. It has been and is and should remain at the center of the message, because what it's saying is that God is going to judge the world, and he's judging the human systems, the military industrial complex, and all the other systems, not just in the United States, but around the world, because people have been repressed, oppressed, martyred, and so forth. And God is going to judge that. Christ is coming again. No, it's not about dominionism. No, it's not about just being happy. No worries, just be happy. It's not that. There is a change. Change is going to come. And that change is Jesus Christ is coming again. And, you know, you have to live, you better be living differently. You better be living in light of the coming of the kingdom of God, because you are being held accountable, will be held accountable to that truth. And whether or not, you know, you are watching, Jesus said in, you know, in Matthew 24:24, I think it was Mark 13:22, you know, what I say unto you, I say unto all, watch. You know, be watchful. It's a fundamental element of the gospel. And so I am an apocalypticist. Mm-hmm. I do believe that we are in the last of the last days. I would not be at all shocked if the Lord returned within the next 10 years. In fact, I'm probably, you know, to the extent that from an analysis standpoint, I would say it's probable, no longer just possible, that the return of Christ is that imminent. It's that near.
Wow. Well, you know, there's no question. We're both premillennialists, meaning that I'm looking at the same thing you're looking at. Jesus is coming back to redeem the earth and to bring judgment on the system that is broken, corrupt, and Babylon in its spiritual nature. And well, praise God for that element of the Christian faith.
For those that are listening that can come, let me just pitch what I'm going to talk about in Ohio.
Yeah.
Or a week from now, I'm doing a talk called The Fate of America, and I'm going to specifically address exactly the question you're asking. I'm going to tell you, you know, in the presentation, I go into 12 reasons why America is Babylon. And I'm also doing a threat assessment as to what threats are the real threats that will ultimately be, probably be the destruction of America. What will happen? I probably won't have time to go into that presentation, but I have done other presentations where I've actually laid out, you know, what will happen in America over the next 10 years.
Very interesting.
I have done that before.
Well, I may be picking in to check that out while I'm at the conference. Folks, again, listen, they're having a conference November 14th and 15th. You can check it out at www.theprophecyforum.com. And today I've been talking with Doug Woodward. His book that we've been talking about, all these cool facts and everything else, is called Uncommon Sense. Hey, Doug, can people get the book yet, or do they have to wait a week or two?
No, they can get it now. It is available. It's on Amazon. I don't have a digital or e-copy yet, but you can order the book on Amazon. You can order it, you know, just do a search on Uncommon Sense, S. Douglas Woodward. You'll see a lot of books out there called Uncommon Sense. My subtitle is A Prophetic Manifesto for the Church in Babylon. And so it's sort of, what do we do now, given how did we get here and what do we do now? That's kind of what the book is trying to address. So Uncommon Sense, you can find it on Amazon. Just look under that title plus my last name, Woodward, and you should find it.
Very cool. Well, hey, Doug, it's been a pleasure to have you on the program, to have conversation on your views and everything else that you've uncovered in your research and all that. I found it entirely fascinating.
Thank you.
And so, folks, until next time, God bless. And Godspeed. Be sure to check us out at www.bridemovement.com. And you can also check out Doug's personal website at www.faith-happens.com.
Discovering the Truth with Dan Duvall is the premier radio program designed to center you on the kingdom of God, to equip you with faith in Jesus Christ, and to unveil the truth behind the lies. This program has been a production of Bride Ministries. You can find us at www.bridemovement.com. At our website, you can contact us, access resources, and support us with donations. We need partners in order to continue to produce our vision, which is to promote unity in the body of Christ worldwide and assist in the creation and development of sheep nations. Partner with us and be sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Until next time, God bless and Godspeed.